Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, 2002. Today's session is titled, The Nature of Children and Child-Parent Relationships, presented by Marcia Bungie. The number is BUM2002-02. Let's listen in.
Because we have children of our own, a little 9-year-old, and we just adopted a 1.5-year-old. And I also teach at church-related college. We talk a lot about the whole person and how you shape a person morally, spiritually. And so you always wonder, you know, before you get these 18-year-olds, what's happened in their home life? And we hear a lot about their struggles, and we have very excellent students, but they do tell us some stories about what has been helpful as they've grown up and what has not been so helpful. And then I'm also very interested in these issues because I'm very concerned, and maybe many of you are, about the situation of children today, many of whom face poverty. We have a high rate of poverty still, even though it's come down about 16% in this country of children live in poverty. Also, just the unevenness of education. We moved from Minnesota, which always felt so bad when it was second in terms of its education, you know, in terms of the state level of education. Now we moved to Indiana, and they're just really happy if they got up, you know, past number 48. They've moved up, and it's so uneven there, the level of the quality of education. So those are my concerns that led me to get very interested in issues regarding children. I put together a book last year with a number of contributors, just trying to see what did the Christian tradition say about children. Did we just said they, you know, sinful and should be beaten to hell, which we have said in some parts of the tradition, or are there other perspectives we had on children? What, it hasn't even really been a theme, a serious theme in theology. So it was really fun to put this book together, looking at what in the world has been said, what have been the conceptions of children and the treatment of children in our tradition. And from that, I just got a lot of fun and interesting insights about maybe there's more in the Christian tradition that can be said about parenting and the obligations of parents to their children and about child-parent relationships. So that's what I'm working on now, this whole issue of the vocation of parenting and trying to think about parenting, use more language to talk about it as a sacred task. So this week I was looking at yesterday, the purpose and paradoxes of parenting. Today, talking more about conceptions of children and how that affects child-parent relationships and what the Bible and the tradition has to say about children. And then tomorrow, spiritual attitudes, responsibilities, and practices. Thursday, contemporary challenges, and Saturday, what the church can do. And in all the sessions, I try to do you know, some theoretical, conceptual kind of work, but also some practical suggestions. So I hope that we'll do that today. This session today is going to focus mainly on, and it's called The Nature of Children and Child-Parent Relationships. And I think our assumptions about children, the way we think about children, our attitudes about children, are bound to affect how we think about what parents should be doing with children. So today I'd just like to explore what are some of our contemporary attitudes about children, how they've been informed by conceptions of children in the past, and then look at some biblical and theological perspectives on children that I found very helpful as we kind of mine the tradition to see what ways have we talked about who children are and how we ought to treat them. And then I would like to also take a little time at the end to talk about what happens when you use a very narrow conception of children, what happens to your view of parenting. So I'll take a few minutes, about 30 minutes, to talk a little bit, and then we'll have a discussion. But and I hope that the session can show that there are some dangers. It's very helpful to have a very rich conception of children if you want to have a rich conception of parenting.
And we don't have a
guide. So let's start out with looking at the child in contemporary culture and some of our attitudes and conceptions about children. I think although we say we live in a very child-friendly culture, a lot of scholars have said it really isn't the case, that we have some kind of narrow attitudes about children. And I brought some, I'll give you a little handout in a minute, some of the literature I've read and some of what I read and hear about what I think are some of the conceptions we have of children. I thought it might be just kind of fun to brainstorm together for a couple minutes about when you think about how do we think about children or what are our attitudes to children in our culture today, what are some of the things that come to mind?
Teenagers are trouble.
Okay, the teenager, yeah. Are trouble. What else?
There's something to love.
Okay. Yeah, they are something to love and lovable. What else comes to mind?
Boys are harder to raise than girls.
Yeah, there's some trouble.
I think girls are harder to raise than boys.
Yeah.
And they're with both.
Yeah. The baby girls. Mm-hmm. What else comes to mind?
Kids are spoiled.
Spoiled. Uh-huh. Yeah, we have to think about kind of in what way, because I think we have that conception too.
They don't have anything to contribute.
Yeah, they really, okay, that's a good point. They don't contribute. And maybe we could follow that up a little more. What do we think they are doing?
Maybe being burdened?
Yeah, a kind of, not just not contributing, but maybe perhaps, right, a burden. And especially, I don't know, an economic burden. What else?
I think we think of them as self-centered.
Uh-huh.
I hope so.
Should be.
Yeah, they are.
They should be.
Yeah, they sure done.
Okay, yeah, maybe that
some parts of their life more than others.
Uh-huh.
Because teenage, I mean, you know, what does the research say, 13, 14, well, especially early teenage, 14, 15, they're all pretty much centered on themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And early on, too, they are.
Yeah.
Preschoolers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now someone was saying, you know, I hope they are, because why do we hope in some way they are? Because we talk about they have certain needs that, you know, have to be met. And in some way need to develop that. Anything else we think about?
I'm overwhelmed at what they're exposed to. And I don't think
yeah.
I'm old, but when I think of what I was exposed to in terms of media, other contacts, even the variety I teach in a school, and
uh-huh.
I think our expectations and what we expose them to and expect them to synthesize in terms of information is, when you realize they've only been thinking, walking, speaking for a short period of time, is overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, what, you know, kids in, the things you hear about, what they're thinking about as fourth and fifth graders, which is something you wouldn't even, I mean, I don't think I'm that old either, but, you know, something you wouldn't think about until high school. Anything else come to mind?
Well, that's true socially as well as academically.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of pressure on kids these days compared to when I was growing up. Way too much pressure.
Yeah.
And the hidden in that is that we have filters that help us to determine what is quality or of value, and they're still developing those filters, and yet we expose them to the same things that many adults see, and it's no
mm-hmm.
wonder for these kiddos, it's just real tough for them to mm-hmm. think what is it they're supposed to sort out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, OPB did a special, and we have a parent group at our church on the teenage brain,
uh-huh.
and most interesting in terms of development, and really the kids just are exposed to too many things too early. They just can't, their brain is just not developed enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's why they kind of space out and whatever.
Yeah. So, socially, academically, I think sexually, people, there's such disturbing programs now and then about what children are exposed to in terms of just watching.
Absolutely.
Even the advertisements.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, I think that gives a very good start. I have a couple. I'm going to just hand this out. You can just kind of follow along. I wrote down the main parts I'm going to be speaking about, but I'll just add a couple other things that I think parallel very much what you were speaking about now. A lot of scholars talk about our view of children is very much influenced nowadays by a kind of market mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And you do see children kind of in these three ways, as property and commodities, or as consumers, or as economic burdens. I think that's part of what's going on. You know, if we talk about property or as commodities, you can see that kind of more blatantly, for example, in these reproductive technology kind of discussions where you want to make sure you get a quality baby, and you talk about the quality eggs, and you pay $50,000 for an Ivy League donor egg,
and you want your quality product, and if you don't get a quality product, you can sue the fertility clinic because of that. So they are kind of blatantly, we see that kind of economic sort of cost-benefit analysis of how we think about kids. But I think even more subtly, we sometimes talk about how we have a child, the child belongs to me, or the way we talk about parental rights, that children have, parents have a right to raise their children as they see fit because they belong to them. Nobody else has anything to say to them about what they're doing with their children. And the view of children as commodities does have these kind of deep roots in the way we've thought about children in the West as kind of property. And if you go back, it's real interesting to look back at some of the Greek philosophy and Roman law. There's a guy named Boswell who wrote a very interesting book about children in the ancient world, Greek and Romans. And he talked about how in Imperial Roman civilization, children were, in a very real sense, the property of their family. And Romans were not legally required to keep any children born to them. So the father had absolute authority over the family and had the legal right to sell, abandon, or even to kill the children. So it's not that everybody did abandon their children, but that was sort of a right. That was the property that belonged especially to the father. I think, as some of you were saying, you know, earlier about spoiled or in terms of, you know, just the stuff they have. They are consumers. They are, you know, really, these advertisers go after these young people because they have a lot of money to spend. They're given a lot of kind of this free money. And so they are almost built to be consumer-oriented. There's a wonderful book called The Overspent American, Why We Want What We Don't Need, by Juliet Shore. She teaches at Harvard. And she cites the studies that show most adults agree that today's youth are highly focused on buying and consuming things, and that many young people themselves affirm very strong materialistic values. Or a guy named Robert Winthrow talks about how children have kind of become almost agents of materialism in their own home, kind of fostering consumerist values, encouraging parents to buy more things for them or give them more pocket money. One study showed if a child whines 9 times, then they will almost surely get that thing that they wanted to buy. So that's a kind of disturbing study.
You know, you don't want to let that fact be known.
No, to children. I almost told my son one day, I said, you know, it takes 9 times. I thought, do not say that. Do not say that. This was just one other real interesting study, because that influence of the market mentality on both parents and children and on our view of children can affect child-parent relationships when they become such consumers. And parents often feel pressured to buy more and more goods and services for their children as a sign that they care for them. And so paying for lessons and sports and all these things is also seen that you're a good parent, that you put out all this money for your kid. And another sign of the effect of this consumer mentality on child-parent relationships is that when parents are pressed for time, they tend to buy their children more things. And there was a very interesting study done with this Juliet Shore in Boston suburbs of the less time parents had with their children. It was an upper middle class neighborhood. The more they spent on their children and the more time they spent with their children, the less they spent on them. So it's almost seen as, you know, well, I can't give you the time, I'm going to give you these consumer goods as sort of some kind of exchange. And then, as you were saying earlier, I think we do sometimes surely see children as economic burdens. We see them as literally not worth our investment, and they are certainly not investing or contributing anything to our community. And you certainly see this in a number of ways. I just put down a few statistics that I always find so disturbing on the back that I think kind of is a sign that we see them as burdens. We don't want to invest as much in them. And for example, that statistic on poverty or health care, that more than 9 million children still are without health care coverage, although that's gotten better with this CHIP program. But we still have a lot of children without health care coverage, or 1 in 8 teenagers never graduate from high school. This child care statistic is from the Children's Defense Fund, too. And it says that most states require about 1,500 hours of training to become a manicurist or hairstylist. But more than 30 states don't require a single hour of training for child care workers. And We were really hit with that when we went from Minnesota, which has pretty good laws about what you need to do to have a daycare, what you need to do, and the qualifications, the ratio of children to the caregiver, to Indiana, where it's almost like a free-for-all. Mm-hmm. And I even blurted out on the phone once, we were calling around seeing what about little preschools, and one woman said, you know, they have 16 children. I said, oh, well, how many caregivers? This was for 3 and 4 years. Well, just me. And I blurted out, well, gosh, isn't that illegal? No, not illegal here. So it's really uneven the way we think about child care state to state. And then some of the other challenges facing family, violence and crime, just a couple other statistics there that you can look at. So I think in that sense, if you look at some of these statistics, you know, if we truly valued children, we would put more investment in terms of our resources and time to help all children in need. But there are a lot of children struggling in many, many ways, education-wise, health-wise, poverty-wise, in this country. I think one other thing, it was interesting when someone said teenagers are trouble. I think one other way we kind of tend to view children is, you know, innocence as infants, as pure and innocent, cute. You got the Baby Gap commercials. Everybody's cute. They're really, nothing's wrong with them, totally innocent. And then teenagers, they are dark creatures whom we must fear. And you even see this in magazine covers. You know, if they have something on how the brain develops, they have a cute little baby face. Then they have teenagers, and it's like, you know, they look like scary creatures. They're talking about teenagers in trouble. And just those covers, how we picture, how we depict what teenagers look like. I think that we have this kind of, they're either all good or all bad, and that's why we struggle sometimes in these cases on, children who've murdered or just done horrendous crimes somewhere between 9 and 14 years old. We kind of don't know what to do because we either want to see them as totally innocent, they couldn't have done anything wrong because they're just kind of like babies, they're children, or we see them as really kind of evil creatures, you got to lock them up for life. So we're kind of split on that. Well, let's just look at now a few views of children, the Bible and the Christian tradition, that I think are very rich and powerful. I think they help give a very, a more complex view of children than either as some of the things we've talked about here or in this terms of this kind of market mentality. So I just want to go briefly through these six and talk a little bit then about the dangers of building a model of parenting on just one or two of these aspects of how we might view children, and then we'll have our discussion. As we look through the biblical text and tradition, I found kind of these six ways, and it was kind of interesting. I was surprised that some of these came out of where you wouldn't expect them, like Calvin. Calvin is, like, he's called the man of total depravity. I mean, you want to talk about, hey, we are depraved creatures and nothing's right, and he'll go on and on about infants too as totally depraved in every way, their reason, their will. But he has some very nice things to say about it. You've got to treat children in a very compassionate way. So, and it did a lot in terms of building hospitals, helping with orphans. So it's really a kind of interesting, complex picture that surprised us who worked on that book. So let's look at this first of all. Children are seen, first of all, as gifts of God and sources of joy and pleasure. Christian and Jewish texts depict children as gifts of God and sources of joy and pleasure in a lot of biblical texts. There are many passages in the Bible that speak of children as gifts of God and signs of God's blessing. Children are seen as ultimately coming from God, and they belong to God. There's a very strong sense that not that they belong to me, they are gifts and they belong to God and to the community. The psalmist, for example, speaks of children as a heritage from the Lord and a reward. Jacob's first wife, Leah, speaks of her sixth son as a precious gift presented by God. Receiving these precious gifts is also expressed as being remembered by God or being given good fortune. And being fruitful with children is being a recipient of God's blessing in many passages in Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, Job, and the Psalms. And I think we can recognize whether or not we have children, whether or not we have biological or adopted children, that children are, in some real sense, gifts. They are gifts to us and to the community. They are greater than our own making, and they will develop in ways we really cannot imagine or control. There's a mystery about even conception. that scientists are still exploring. Even though we have these great advances in reproductive technology, we still don't understand and cannot control all the factors that allow for conception and a full-term pregnancy. And furthermore, we all, if we think a little more, we have this sense that children are more than just our own. They are God's gift. They are also gifts to the community. They will grow up to be not only our sons and daughters, but also husbands, wives, neighbors, citizens, professionals. So contributing something out there in our society. Related to that notion that children are gifts and signs of God's blessing, the Bible and the tradition also say a lot about how children are sources of joy, of genuine joy and just pleasure. Abraham and Sarah rejoice at the birth of their son Isaac. News of a son made Hilkiah very glad. An angel tells Elizabeth that her child will be a joy and delight. And Jesus speaks about a mother's joy at bringing a child into the world. And there are many other passages like that. Now, parents in the past perhaps wanted children for reasons we don't always emphasize today, such as for perpetuating the nation or for being ensuring that someone would take care of them in their old age. But I think, nevertheless, there is a sense today and in the past that children are great blessings. And one of the great blessings of parenthood is just the simple joy and pleasure of watching children and seeing them thrive. A second way, and a very common way, that children are depicted in the Christian tradition is as sinful. Calvin is the one who says, "The whole nature of children is a seed of sin, so it cannot be but hateful and abominable by God." And then Johann Arndt, a pietist, goes on to claim that within children lie hidden an evil root of a poisonous tree, an evil seed of the serpent. And Jonathan Edwards, he was an American preacher and very important in terms of a revival in the United States, but he goes on and on. We have an essay in there about Jonathan Edwards, but he claimed that as innocent as even infants appear to be, if they are out of Christ, they are not so in God's sight. They are young vipers and are infinitely more hateful than vipers. That's the nature of the child. And a lot of the biblical texts on which this view is based, I'll just mention a few, like in Genesis 8:21, it says that the inclination of every human heart is evil from childhood. Or Proverbs 22 says that folly is bound up in the heart of the child. Or Psalm 51 claims, "We are sinful at birth, and even from birth the wicked go astray." Or Paul, who claims that we are all under sin and no one is righteous, not even one. All have somehow sinned in Adam. Now, on the surface, this way of thinking about children seems much more negative than thinking about children as innocent, you know, or as kind of not innocent, but just having a potential for good or evil. So you kind of wonder, what good does it do to speak about children as sinful in any way? Isn't the view of children, this view, hopelessly out of touch with contemporary psychological conceptions of children that emphasize their potential for development, their need for loving nurture? Doesn't the emphasis on sin lead to harsh and even brutal treatment of children? And certainly, in some cases, this is true, that viewing children has led to harsh treatment, abuse, and even the death of children in the past. There are a number of very interesting recent studies on the religious roots of child abuse, and they talk about how viewing children as sinful, as depraved, particularly in some strains of European and American Protestantism, has led some Christians to emphasize that the job of the parents mainly is to break a child's will, and at a very early age, and this can be done most often with physical punishment. So, according to some of these studies, the ideal that children are sinful and thus must have their wills broken is also supported by the notion that God punishes God's people and that therefore parents must punish their children. So this kind of reasoning and the emphasis on the depravity of children has led in some cases to the physical abuse and even death of children. Cases like this have led some scholars to assume that if you talk about children as sinful in any way, it will lead to inhumane treatment. But we found, and I'll say a little more about how you might retrieve in a critical way a sense that children are sinful. We found that that's not always the case, that some theologians who said very strongly, and you can't believe the language, it goes on and on, serpents, vipers, worms, I mean just on and on, the depravity of children. But it almost gave an egalitarian kind of way to think about everybody, that everybody's that way. And so it's sort of interesting, because for some of these theologians, it kind of wipes away this social ranking that someone's better than the other. Everybody's wiped, you know, kind of off the plate here. So that it opened them up to really doing a lot of wonderful social service for all children, poor, rich, educated, not educated. So a lot of orphanages, a lot of hospitals were started by people who said very strongly things like that they're very sinful, but they didn't treat them in this brutal way. So I want to say how it is that that's true, because there is this sort of assumption, as soon as you say sinful, you sort of beat the kids to hell. That's what you got to do. And it has been the case sometimes. It's a horrible chapter in the history of Christianity. But there's been other sort of ways to think about sinful that I think could be kind of helpful. And I just want to mention three of those on here. That when we say that children are sinful, one way of thinking about this, we're saying, on the one hand, that they're born in a state of sin. Well, what does that mean? On the one hand, it means they're born in a situation and into a world that's not what it ought to be. That their parents aren't perfectly loving parents. They're in some sense broken. They're not going to be the perfect, all-loving providers for them. Or the social institutions in which they're born, the schools, the church, the state, in some way, they are not also free from corruption. There's a kind of brokenness about them. The community in which they live, no matter how safe, has elements of injustice and violence. So all these levels of human relationship are not the way they ought to be. That's sort of one way we think about when we talk about sort of they're born in a state of sin. Another aspect of the state of sin, on the other hand, is that in addition to the brokenness of relationships and institutions into which they're born, human beings find a certain kind of brokenness even within themselves. And that as we grow and develop and become more conscious of our actions, we see how easy it is for us sometimes to be self-centered, to be inordinately self-centered on the one hand, or to place inordinate importance on the approval of other people. So there's a kind of sense that you get, another way we talk about it is you're not kind of centered. You're not centered. You're either so self-centered you can't open yourself to love others, or you're so centered on people's opinions that you don't really, aren't able to give in the way you need to give. So that's another way we talk about sort of this state of sin, or almost people, this is a way we talk about original sin. It's a way of speaking about it. It's a way of taking account of the brokenness in which we all, children and adults, find ourselves. The idea of original sin is an attempt to make sense out of the actual world in which we find ourselves. We are born into structures of sin and evil larger than ourselves that can affect our actions before we even can take any control of them. And what the doctrine of original sin really signifies is this kind of the tendency sometimes we have of a kind of entrapment of human freedom in a tendency to either focus too much on the self or focus too much on the approval of others. A second way one could talk about children as being sinful is that we're also saying they carry out actual sins. They are moral agents who sometimes do activities, carry out activities that are not life-giving, but instead these activities are self-centered and harmful to themselves and harmful to others. Speaking about a child as sinful is part of taking into account a child's capacity to accept some degree of accountability and responsibility for harmful actions. So if we don't have to say that necessarily so much about infants, and most of these theologians never said they could do actual sins because they're too weak and too little. But there is a sense, as you grow and develop, you do attain more accountability, and if you have some sense of accountability, then there's some way you can do wrong, harmful actions. If we do admit, children have some kind of accountability, some kind of moral capacities. So that's another aside of this, what we mean when we talk about sins. And certainly, the view of actual sins of children can be easily abused when theologians equate a child's physical and emotional needs as sins. There's just this horrible passage in Augustine where he's talking about this nursing child who just got off his mother's breast and then is really mad because the mother's nursing another child. And so Augustine says, look at that. Sign of total sin, you know, this total self-centered kid. And we see it all over. It's just like me wanting my stuff, wanting to be. So we don't want to do that. We don't want to mistake the real physical and emotional needs of children with actual sins. But there is a way it can be helpful to talk about how are children developing morally? How are they taking up responsibilities? How are they accountable? So that's the side of that that I think can be very helpful. And just finally, although it's important to recognize children are born in a state of sin and are moral beings capable of actual sins, a third important aspect of the notion is that children are sinful, emphasized by many theologians in the tradition, is that infants and young children are not as sinful as adults and therefore don't need as much help to love God and their neighbor. They have not gotten into bad habits or developed negative thoughts and feelings that reinforce destructive behavior. So the positive way of saying the same thing is that young people are more easily formed. It's easier to nurture them and put them on a straight path because they haven't got into these terrible habits. And that's why most of the theologians we looked at have said you need to be very kind to children and very compassionate. They're like tender reeds because you don't have to be doing radical therapy with them, like with adults who really need a big conversion. They just need a little sort of guidance, a little bending. And so that's why, even when they're saying it's sinful, it's not sort of like, okay, beat them to hell now. It's more this sense of, well, they haven't got into these destructive habits, so you can kind of nurture them in a positive way, primarily through loving kindness and compassion. So let's look at the next one, number three. A third central perspective of children in the tradition is that they're developing beings who need instruction and guidance. Most secular and religious traditions of child-rearing assume that children are developing, they're on their way to becoming adults, and so they need nurture and guidance from adults to help them develop morally, spiritually, intellectually. They need to learn the basic skills of reading, writing, thinking critically. They also need to learn to be taught what's right and wrong, to develop particular virtues, to really start thinking about particular values and beliefs that are important to them. And so throughout the Bible, we see a lot of passages that say parents are to nurture their children and to guide them. They're supposed to train them in the way that they should go. They're supposed to bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord, to tell their children about faithfulness and the deeds of the Lord. Parents are to teach their children about the words of the law and to teach them what is right and just and fair. In our time, I think we believe this very much. We say that parents are to attend to the whole being of the child and provide them with emotional, academic, moral, and spiritual guidance. So in addition to providing children with good education and teaching them skills that are necessary to earn a living and raise a family, adults are, we think, are to instruct children about faith, to help them develop moral sensibilities, character, and virtue so that they can love God and the neighbor and contribute to society and contribute to the common good. So that's another way, a very strong way, children are talked about in the Bible and the tradition. Number four. Fourth, albeit more neglected theme than this one about the sinful nature of children that you find in the tradition, that I think helps avoid mistreatment of children and is very powerful, is to see children as made in the image of God. And that notion, made in the image of God, is very complex. It has been interpreted in many ways. So we can't go into all of that here, but just two aspects that I think are very important as we think about children and we say they are made in the image of God are the following. First, if we say that children are made in the image of God, then we are saying they are fully human, and they are worthy of respect, they are worthy of dignity. Although children are developing, we have to say at the same time they are whole, they are complete human beings. There's a wonderful little book by Herbert Anderson and Susan Johnson regarding children, and they try to emphasize very much this notion that children and childhood is not a prelude to adulthood. You know, the children are somehow on their way to being human beings, but that the child already has the value and depth of full humanity. And that's a very powerful notion, to think about children in that way, as genuinely full human beings who deserve our respect, who deserve to be treated with compassion and justice, and not on their way, a kind of almost human being. I think alongside of that, it's important to remember that both girls and boys are made in the image of God. All children, male and female, are fully human and worthy of respect. And this idea has always been very important, for basic human rights kinds of discussions, to believe that every person in some way is made in the image of God and deserves respect and justice and dignity. Also, a sort of second part of that made in the image of God is that in a Christian perspective, if we say children are made in the image of God, they, like all human beings, have a purpose. And that purpose would be to glorify God and to love and serve the neighbor. So they are fully human, and in a Christian perspective, you would say they're also sort of meant to be, their nature is meant to glorify God and to love and serve others. Well, let's look at number five. This one is also a theme that's really powerful in the Gospels, but not so much in the tradition. And that's seeing children as moral witnesses, models of faith, and sources of revelation. And I just want to point out a couple Gospel passages that are so striking when you look at them, how children are depicted in these Gospel passages. It's very striking for the time, and I think even for today. So we're not going to look at all of them. I just want to look on the second. This is actually the third page. That, there's this very strong idea that children can be models of faith for adults. They can be models of spiritual maturity. And that comes mainly from these passages. Let's just look at Matthew 18, the third one down on the third page, where it says, Matthew 18, third one down, third page. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." So that's a powerful passage, and you see it kind of picked up now and then in the tradition, but it's very striking for this time when children were really seen as very much as property, and we don't see even in the Jewish text the strong notion that children are somehow, you're supposed to become childlike, that there's a positive element of being childlike. Most often childlikeness is seen as ignorance, and there are certainly other passages in the Bible that depict childlikeness in that way, but this is a different way of looking at it. Or look at, let's see, two more down, Matthew 19, 13 to 15. "Then little children were being brought to him in order that he might lay his hands on them and pray, and the disciples spoke sternly to those who brought them. But Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me. Do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of heaven belongs.' And he laid his hands on them, and he went on his way." So that passage and the parallel passage in Luke, people were bringing even infants to him that he might touch them. And when the disciples saw it, they sternly ordered them not to do it. It's sort of like, not with your time. You know, this is not, hey, what we're supposed to be doing here, Jesus. But Jesus called for them and said, "Let the little children come to me. Do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of God belongs." truly, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will never enter it. So these are very, again, striking passages for this period. They aren't always brought up, but it's very interesting to think about what is childlikeness? What is being as a little child? And what is, why is that so important spiritually? And so a lot of theologians have kind of struggled with this. What does that mean? And I'll just mention a couple of kind of interesting interpretations of that. There's a guy, Schleiermacher, Friedrich Schleiermacher, a 19th century theologian, who wrote beautiful sermons about parenting and children. And he interpreted childlikeness as being able to live in the present. That's what a child is like. They can live fully in the moment. They have no anxiety about the past or the future. And this particular essence of the child, that they're all together in the moment, that for Schleiermacher was something that is very important for your deep spirituality, that you need that to be able to mature spiritually, to be able to be in the present. That for children, he says, the past disappear for them. The future, they know nothing of it. Each moment exists only for itself, and this accounts for the blessedness of a soul content in innocence. So he kept saying we need to learn something from that about the powerful way they can be in the present. He also said that children are models for adults in the sense that they keep adults fresh and cheerful. They remind us of the fact that God created us to live simply. He talks a lot about, this is very much in tune with Holden, but he said, you know, they can live with so little, and they're so happy with a few little things there in front of them, and that they can live simply like that and enjoy and have this kind of playful attitude. He thought that was also important for adult spirituality. Children help adults shed their obsession with the complexities of work and public life. Indeed, children draw adults back to the most basic of human relationships. In spite of manifold adult failures, children are also flexible and forgiving. We had, so he thought that was a really wonderful element of children, that they're so flexible and forgiving. I had a friend, she actually just died of cancer, but we kept taking her to these treatments in the hospital, and her son, the same age as our son, and they were six at the time, and they were arguing about, it was a theological argument about God, if God had parents. And one was sort of thinking, well, you know, Jesus is sort of God, and Jesus must have had parents. I think God does have parents. And the other side, no, I don't think, you know, because God is sort of the first, they're sort of, they have this strong. Then they said, the one little kid said, well, let's stop arguing. And my son said, okay. And we laughed at that so much. We said, wow, what if we could do that in our marriages? You know, we just said, oh, yeah, okay. Let's stop arguing. They went and played with the truck.
Let's go play.
Yeah, let's go play with the truck. So I think there's something to that. Just one more example of a guy who tried to interpret this was Karl Rahner, a 20th century Catholic theologian, who said children are examples because they lack a kind of false ambition, and he felt that got so in the way of our spiritual journey in life. They lack a kind of artificiality. They don't seek honor or fame. They are guileless and serene. So childhood for Rahner is not only a stage of existence kind of on your way, but for him he talked about it as a spiritually mature state which is required to enter the kingdom of God and which gives one an attitude of infinite openness and wonder. And then just finally, and I think we hear more about this, that children in the Bible and tradition are depicted as orphans, neighbors, and strangers who need to be treated justly and with compassion. There are many passages that have to do with our responsibility to children, especially orphans. There's a lot of commands that we are to help the orphan and the neighbor, and in that sense we are to think about children also as our neighbors who need to be treated with justice and compassion. So I think together, you know, if you look at all these views, all these kind of as a kind of a whole, you get a much more complex picture that I think helps combat narrow views of children in contemporary culture and even in the tradition. And I think there's some dangers. I'll just go through this very briefly. I won't spend more time than just looking at this together, the last section here. But if you focus too much on one element or aspect of trouble, I think, into how you start thinking about parenting and how we are to treat children. For example, if you view children under A there, 3A, primarily as innocent or as gifts of God and models of faith, there's something very positive about that. Because you do enjoy your children, and children need to be enjoyed. I had a colleague, and I felt so bad because she really did not enjoy her children. I thought, who is going to enjoy that child? Enjoy being with a child. It was such a burden for her. It was almost like, you know, kind of like, we're going to get this over with, got the pregnancy, got to get this over with, then got to get back to work. There was no joy in just being with that child and seeing that child as a person to enjoy. And so anyway, there's something very positive about this, but you can neglect to recognize a child's own moral capacities and responsibilities, and we minimize the role parents play in a child's moral development. Like, parents start then to be seen as, hey, if a child's innocent and kind of perfect when they're born, that what you're supposed to do is stand back and don't do anything to mess it up. And if you do, and if a child gets messed up, it's your fault. And a child has no then accountability. So there's a problem if you do it too much that way. Or if you do it the other way, if we view children primarily sinful and in need of instruction, then we do emphasize the role of parents in guiding and instructing the children. We recognize a child's own moral capacity and responsibilities, but we can neglect to learn from children, to delight in them, to be open to what God reveals to us through them. So the role of parents can easily focus narrowly on instruction, discipline, and punishment. And I do appreciate, I see this in the past a lot. We also see it today in some of the more fundamentalist literature on parenting. I appreciate very much that among the fundamentalists, there's a real interest in parenting, and that's positive. They take it seriously, and I think the mainline churches have neglected to talk enough about parenting. So there's something very positive. They have a lot of programs for kids. They're growing and growing, partly because they have a lot of services for people. A lot of, you know, parenting classes. They have classes for single parents. They recognize people are in need, and we need to help these people trying to raise these children. So there's something so positive. But some of the literature is so narrow, like even this Dare to Discipline, this Dobson. You know, he talks about, yes, we must love our children, do all this. But he really depicts children mainly as defiant. And he does talk about breaking the will. He talks about you can start punishing them and talks a lot about spanking them even at 18 months, even though we know a lot of medical studies say that's not the best way to discipline children. And he doesn't seem to realize that in many cases, you know, physical punishment can lead in some cases to abuse. And there's no sense in that book that you could maybe learn something from a child, or that you can delight in a child, and that they have something to teach you in your own spiritual journey as you raise this child. So I think there's a danger in that kind of approach too to parenting. And then finally, if we view children as neither innocent or sinful, but having the capacity for either good or evil, there's certainly something positive in that, because we do see the important role parents play in the moral and spiritual development of children, that we need to be intentional about helping to raise our children. But if you do see sort of children as on the way to becoming human, sometimes we fail to recognize that children are made in the image of God. They are already fully human, and that they can be models of faith for us, and kind of to be open, a little more open to what we can learn from children. So that's what I have to say. And I thought we could open our discussion. I have, you know, all these things I'm going to be talking about, but today maybe, and we could focus on any aspect of your concerns about children that you'd like. But I also was just very interested in today's discussion about what do you think have been very helpful spiritual perspectives of children for you. How have you thought about children that have been very helpful for you, either in treating your own children, or whether or not you have children of your own children in your midst? What are kinds of images and conceptions have been helpful for you? And I was also just wondering, you know, because that is such a neglected theme in the tradition, that children are kind of moral witnesses. They see what we're doing. They're also models of faith, as we talked about. I didn't turn the page, but there's a couple passages in the New Testament about children as vehicles of revelation. That doesn't mean they're more
in tune with God necessarily, but they can be vehicles, a way we see something about God through them. And I just wondered, do you have examples of that? And to just kind of test that out together. So I'm interested in those two questions specifically, but we could talk about some of these other themes too.
One of the things that comes to my mind is that children's behavior has a reason.
Children's behavior?
There's a reason for good behavior and there's a reason for misbehavior. And understanding what's behind misbehavior is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And finding out is not always easy.
Yeah.
But finding out is very important in terms of instruction.
That follows. Right.
And you have to, and that usually has to be done by getting the perspective of the child, whether it's an infant that's 2 weeks old or an 18-year-old teenager.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at the situation through their eyes.
Yeah. I think, you know, even like those Terrible Tuesday talk about, you know, sometimes a kid, they're trying to explore so much, and when you read about that, it is so helpful to know some of what they're going through developmentally, isn't it? Just to know what they're trying to do, cause and effect, they're trying to, you know, sort out their own identity somewhat at that period, and I found that was so helpful. Or just the fact, are they fed? Did they get enough sleep? Just some, a lot of times they have a tantrum because they just are really hungry, or you pushed them, you haven't paid attention to their physical needs. So that's a very good point. I think you can do that kind of all along to try to figure out at least some of the reasons.
Yeah, it's very complex.
It is.
Because the degree that the child is bonded to its caregivers, you know, affects its behavior tremendously, I think.
Right, right.
And if you have a child that can't bond, and there's some children that for some reason in their genetic makeup they're not able to bond, very difficult child to raise, and their behavior is going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But if you understand why that behavior is difficult, you're not going to approach the child totally different than you see it as a child that's misbehaving.
Mm-hmm. This is somewhat related, but you know, Calvin, it was kind of interesting. He noticed how hard teenagers are, and they all talked about it. Luther, too, like the sexuality and the adolescence. It was really interesting. But Calvin said when you really get, it's really difficult, or they're really, it was important for him, he said, to remember they are gifts of God and that they are made in the image of God. That helped, somehow got him through these problems. That's not quite related to what you were saying, but I think it's sort of, when you can't figure out all the reasons, sometimes it helps to have just a deeper commitment to this child.
Well, one of the problems that I see is I work with a lot of parents and children, is quite a few, I'd say maybe close to half of the parents I work with are really frustrated at being parents and don't know how to parent successfully, and they really don't want to parent.
Mm-hmm.
They wish they didn't have a parent.
I see that a lot in the school system. You have parents coming in for parent-teacher conferences, and what they really want to talk about is not math or reading. What they really want to say is, how do I get my kid to go to bed at night? He's still awake at 10:30, and I can't get him to go to bed. And you're realizing it's basic parenting that a lot of folks are still missing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of frustration in getting children to do chores. You know, the spoiled child is one aspect, and I see parents, or I see families like that, but I also see parents who look at their children as assets, almost like servants.
Mm-hmm.
And when these children are not doing their job, the parents are angry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a taskmaster would be angry rather than a parent.
I see parents who, their children have no accountability. Even at an age like 10, 11, 12, no chores, nothing. And then you get that other extreme where it's almost like, hey, you're going to do the drudgery.
Homes the children are doing the laundry, the cleaning, and the dishes, and the meals.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are angry if they don't.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
How did you get them to do that?
Yeah.
I missed something.
There's a lot of controversy in those homes. I mean, it's a battle going on every hour of the day.
One real disturbing trend to me is the trend towards when it's difficult to figure out and the child is not conforming to what the mold is that one thinks they should be, is to medicate them.
Mm. Yes.
As a first avenue rather than rather than to figure out what the and I think that there's a it's my personal opinion that many of the children, the percentage of medicated children is way too high.
Right.
For behavior modification.
Right. They are showing more studies that children are over medicated. And it's interesting with the boys, someone brought up boys in trouble, and that 6 boys to every 1 girl is on this Ritalin, or is seen as having attention deficit. There's a really interesting book, this one, there are boys, I don't agree with everything in it, but it talks about that imbalance with the medication for boys.
Well, it isn't even, and that's the thing I actually primarily meant, but at the same time, I'm surprised at how many people do not understand basic nutrition and the role of caffeine.
Right.
People will say, well, no, my child can't have sugar, and then they will immediately turn around and let them have 200 milligrams of caffeine.
Yeah.
And then they will not make any correlation that there's a behavior, between what you gave them and what their behavior is.
Right. I just read that something like they were so happy because it got up to something like 21% of our children are having nutritious meals. They were so happy because it came up from 15% or something. And you wonder, really, how are they getting, if you have that, the caffeine, the sugar, all
or
that.
Or even the simplest example of somebody sending their child over to play and not having fed the child for some number of hours, and you just kind of happen to figure out that the child hasn't even eaten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're behaving poorly, and then you feed them, and lo and behold,
doing a little better. That's a very good point.
And those are in educated.
Yeah.
Educated people that I mean, as I say, I just think it's a huge gap in our.
Mm-hmm. I think it takes a lot of time and attention to really make sure their schedule's okay and feeding them everything. That statistic is about this 27 hours of television is always so disturbing to me because people aren't eating together anymore. So then, it's almost like a kid can pick up sort of anything. You just find what you want to eat. When dad gets home or mom, we'll do something else here. And so you're not even kind of attending to, well, did they have any vegetables or fruit? Did they get any calcium today?
Mm-hmm.
So we have, adopted this little girl, and so we have they have this first start where they come in your home and kind of check things out, nutrition, development, speech, and it was very interesting because the nutritionist was saying, oh, it's so sad because our little girl has this rickets, which is lack of DNA, and didn't get enough in the orphanage. So we're trying to address that. And he was saying he couldn't believe the number of biological parents who had their children from birth, who love their children, but the nutrition is so terrible for these kids under 3, and they've had serious problems, and some of them irreversible because they didn't attend to their nutrition. Hmm. What other concerns or other perspectives on these questions or others you have?
Well, I think the spiritual perspective that helps me is that they're children of God and that they have gifts. When I get to the end of the day and the day has been challenging, it's one thing that helps me is to tell my children that they are children of God or that they're my gift or my blessing. It helps me to sort of end the day with, I love you, and you're my gift, and you're my blessing, and even though we had a horrid day or a challenging day, that's the way I feel about you.
I remember trying to remember, now my children are 22 and 26 now, so you try and think back, what is it that stands out in your head? And being in a pastor's family, we were always in church multiple times in a week, and you forget the importance of that kind of routine. And I was never a regimented, you must sit still and shut up kind of a mom. You know, I would bring things to do. And my kids really learned early on, you know, how to fit into the church community. But I'd forgotten that the things that are repetition that happen over and over again are being heard by them in a different way. Uh-huh. And two things my son said, and he was young, maybe 5 or 6 or 7, I don't remember anymore now exactly what age, but one was the reading of the Passion story on Palm Sunday, the lengthy reading, the one that goes all the way up to just about the crucifixion. And he'd heard that story, I know, many times before, but it was like a light went on. We got to the end of the story, and of course it stops before the resurrection. And he pulls on my sleeve and he said, "Wow," he said, "this must be continued next week, right?" I just knew that. I was like, whoa, somebody's got the idea here.
Yeah, let's continue.
And the other one was in the prayers of the day, we had always, as many congregations do, had an extended list of people for whom we were praying, most of whom I did not mm-hmm. even know. But mm-hmm. And there was one man named Sumner Gurney. I never met Sumner Gurney, but he had such an unusual name, and we never talked about Sumner at home. I mean, it just, I don't know why. It was someone that we didn't know. Apparently my husband did, but we didn't know. And for years and years, it seemed like Sumner was in the prayers, and he apparently had died one week, and we got there on the next Sunday, and we skipped over Sumner's name, and Justin said, "Mom, they forgot Sumner. They forgot Sumner." And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, these kids mm-hmm. listening. They do hear this, even though you think they're sitting there fiddling with whatever, you mm-hmm. know, they do hear mm-hmm. all that stuff. But I think too often parents say, oh, my kids don't get anything out of church, thinking they're going to sit there and do all the things adults do. Mm-hmm. But it is going in their mind in a different mm-hmm. way. They're synthesizing all mm-hmm. that great stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the repetition and the routine is very positive, and it gets that message down. And I think that idea that children are gifts of God can be so powerful when they're struggling with, you know, the parents. Mm-hmm. If you just keep saying, you're my kid, and hey, you look at your parent and say, I don't like you that much, and you're really not that great of a person, and there are times we're all that way. It's a very powerful thing that you are a child. Well, you're greater than this, and see the needs of others.
I cringe when in church you have a parent who is so angry at their child. They are mm-hmm. literally shaking. You know, shut up and be quiet. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, what a mm-hmm. terrible witness to God's love to that child that you're that angry at that child in church.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere, but you know, yes. So obvious to me, that's where I'm seeing them in a public setting.
Yeah, I think a lot of churches are trying to be welcoming to children right. in a way so that people can still get through the service and sure. hear the message, but be welcoming, because those patterns, McDonald's mm-hmm. knows it, the patterns start early, mm-hmm. you know, of what you see is important, and to help them feel welcome and invited is so important, I think. Were you going to say, something?
I don't remember now.
Oh, okay.
What struck me as the views of children is it kind of correlates with the temperament.
Yeah.
I have one that I can look at and see as a gift of God.
Right.
The other one is so hard to do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Because she's the one that is more in need of.
How old is she?
6.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she's just more everything.
Yeah. With my, you notice I told the stories about my son. With my daughter, it was an opposite struggle. And still many wonderful things, but it was a very, very difficult time. And she actually, which we didn't even address, and that's a whole other issue, children that have emotional or mental, what's the right term here? It's not even an illness necessarily, but a difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
And for all the love and care and concern, there are some that, you know, it's a lifetime of experience trying to find out what is the best way to keep communicating and keep the channels open.
And their temperament is just there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
There. They kept telling me in the womb that she was a very active child. Everything she would say, how alert, after she was born, she's, you know, 2 months old. Oh, she's so alert.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know, she never sleeps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they're just so opposite in that respect. And yeah. one goes with the gift mm-hmm. of God, and one goes with the one that you have to control. Or
still a gift, it just wasn't what you were expecting when you opened it.
Right.
Yeah.
A gift
of hi! Yeah.
I sort of have a similar thing. I live at Olin now, so we parent
that somebody said under the scrutiny of our 40 closest friends.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually been a real gift. My oldest child is, I mean, I consider him to be challenging. But the thing that started happening here, I mean, I was kind of reminded, first of all, as soon as I stopped, somebody said to me one time, because I was just beating myself up over his behavior, and somebody said, I mean, you're not responsible for his behavior. He's who he is, and I mean, it's not your responsibility to control that. I mean, you try to deal, I mean, he's got really strong emotions, strong opinions, and just like I taught anger management classes before I came here, it's our job sort of to teach him to deal with those things. But anyway, my point is, combined with that, the other thing that living sort of in this community has done is, I mean, he would do these outlandish things, and people would laugh, and people would, you know,
provide reinforcement. Yeah, reinforcement for what he was doing.
Well, no, it was good.
They would appreciate it.
I started to look and I say, oh, this is not. I mean, it was because I was trying so hard to control him and make him into what I thought was a great and, I mean, you know, a good child that I was making our lives miserable when I started seeing people get enjoyment out of his dramatis. That kind of stuff. I started appreciating him more and maybe not trying to control his behavior as much as it's made a huge difference, both in his behavior and in our relationship.
Well, yeah, there's something about discerning the different gifts the child brings, that they all, you know, there's something, even a really strong vocal child, there's something positive about that they are determined, that they have some will to get the project completed. I mean, you need some people like that, and you certainly want to protect from destructive behavior or behavior that's harmful to others, but to kind of being able to discern their gifts and see their gifts is a kind of a challenge, I think. But sometimes other people, like you're saying, can help you see that.
You're not so close.
Right, right. And a lot of these cellular are so interesting that we project so much sometimes of ourselves what we want our child to be like, when sometimes we need to step back and look and see what they're offering. But it can be a struggle that, like one parent, you know, my mother, she always says there were four kids and we're all so different, that she was one parent with her sort of gifts, and some of them fit better with some of the other kids. But when you can get a community to help you, it's very helpful, it's good, a community to help. And we need that support in the church, I think, among neighbors, friends, and relatives for raising children. I think our time is up and we could stay and talk a little more, but I did want to tell you, I do have a kind of a selected resources on parenting and nurturing the moral and spiritual life of children. It's a more sort of general bibliography if you're interested in that. I have that as one other handout. So thank you for your contributions.